Aloha, this is Carol Cox. Please join me on Sundays here on KWAI 1080 AM from 8 to 10 AM, where we will discuss waste, fraud, and abuse in government, the environment, and some lighthearted subjects, and other issues you might have. That's Sundays, 8 AM to 10 AM, here on KWAI 1080 AM.
Time for the Carol Cox Show on K108, heard every Sunday from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. If you have questions for Carol, our number here is 524-1080, 524-1080.
Good morning and welcome to the Carol Cox Show. That was Flight of the Bees. We are obviously going to be talking about bees, and I think we have a pretty good show all gathered together here. We're swarming, I guess. Anyway, you know the plight of the bees, the honeybee especially, and many things are suspected causing the decline worldwide, believe it or not. So I thought I would reach out and try to bring to our shores directly more information on what specifics others are finding around the nation and around the world. So this morning, we're going to have a panel of call-ins from various places. We're going to have Mr. Joe Fahey, Alicia Forster with Alicia Forster Scott with PollinatorsSupportMovement.com or BGAP, and then we have also Mr. Dave Hunter with BGAP, and Dr. Stephen Peterson, PhD from Modesto, California. We'll have Ms. Susan Wainwright. You can get her at Bug Lady, and we'll talk more about that, Pennsylvania, have them to give a more formal introduction. She's from Pennsylvania. Dave Hunter is from Seattle. Joe Fay up there in Milwaukee, and Alicia is from New Mexico, and Miss Carol Sevilla Brown from Cape Cod. So hopefully we can learn something in speaking with them briefly. And I also have in the studio Mr. Howard McGinnis, our local residential resident bee expert and apiary. Good morning, Howard. Anyway, I have on the line also waiting. We have Alicia. Good morning. Good morning, Alicia.
Good morning, Carol. Aloha.
Good morning. How are you today?
We're doing great. Also on the line is Dave Hunter.
Right. Good morning, Dave. How are you?
Good morning, Carol. Wonderful, actually. Thank you.
All righty. Hey, listen, we're running a little glitches here, but we'll work through them. And anyway, and Mara, give a shout-out to my technician who's normally here. He's still ill and hospitalized, and hopefully he's making a great recovery. Francis, that is. So tell us something, Elisa, about yourself and Dave, if you could, briefly. And I have others on the line waiting to talk, so go ahead.
Yes, thank you for having us on, Carol. I'm here in Albuquerque, New Mexico, grounding details for Bees Week. And Bees Week is coming up in June, 3rd through 9th. And in 2012, I founded Pollinator Support Movement. And the purpose of the launch was to provide the general public with more information about the decline of bees. And since that time, I've come together with Dave Hunter in an arrangement where we're both working on that same purpose, saving and restoring bees in the food supply chain.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and just to let you know, I'm getting a large clicking noise, so if there's something you can do to control that, but it's intermittent. Go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, actually, it could have been me typing. Apologize. And my background is more kind of represent the doing side. I've been working with a whole lot of people that are concerned about the honeybees, and to the fact that the honeybees are still continuing to have problems, and a lot of team of scientists that I work with have started to shift money from only save the bee to it's going to be pretty scary pretty soon. What else is out there? And so whether I'm an Orchard Bee Association, kind of a commercial group of people, or working as a board of advisors on other teams out there, the intent is we don't have enough bees. The honeybees not doing well, the bumblebees, a lot of our native bees. And so everything I'm working on is trying to help people realize they can raise bees and they're instrumental in solving the problems.
Okay, all righty. Well, anyway, let me see who's here on the line. We, as I say, we have a lineup of people here. And I do apologize. I didn't expect this glitch. So, good morning, Colin. Welcome to the Carol Cox Show.
Hi, this is Steve Peterson.
Hi, good morning, Dr. Peterson. How are you?
Good.
I have good Alicia here. And Dave on the line.
Right.
So if you could, go ahead and share with us, and I do apologize with some of the feedback. So go ahead.
Right. I'm an entomologist for ag pollen, and we're based near Modesto, California, and we're a pollination service company, and we provide honeybees, and we're also involved in providing blue orchard bees for almond pollination.
Mm-hmm. And with this program, the varroa mite, can you share with us what your concerns are and what problems are presented with the varroa mite?
Yeah, you know, the varroa mite has been with us since the mid-80s in the United States. It's probably the biggest single concern to honeybee keepers. It's a mite, and that means it has a very rapid life cycle. So in 10 days, it can go from egg to adult. And this means it can have many generations in a hive, and in a short amount of time, and it can build up quickly. These mites are parasites, so they feed on the blood of the insect and basically shorten its life, make it weaker, and we're now seeing that they also transmit viruses while they're feeding on the bees. So they're difficult to control, as you might imagine. We're trying to kill a bug on a bug, basically. So and while there are a few different controls that are out there, nothing is 100% effective on them.
Bee population can grow quickly. The mite population can grow quickly. I think we're fortunate in a way because we are a tropical environment. We do have some control methods that appear to be working, as well as nature with, we've just seen an increase in swarming. Bees swarming like crazy, both from managed and feral colonies, and that's been helping a little bit. But I look at, you know, varroa, it weakening the hive, allowing it our secondary pest, which I think is really a primary pest, the small hive beetle, allows it to take over. Using up resources, we're spending a lot of time trying to fight varroa and the results from it. So I think it is probably the root of all our problems.
Mm-hmm. Steve?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. There's a couple of things here that the decline in bee population is attributed to. There's a myth, it a myth, of cell phone towers. Is there any truth? Is that fiction or fact?
Well, so far, this is not. There isn't much evidence to support that hypothesis. There was a couple of small studies, one in particular from Switzerland, that showed that what they did is they took cell phones and they put them in colonies and then recorded the sounds that the honeybees made. And people really jumped on this because the honeybees did, when the cell phones were activated, the honeybees did what's called piping, and it's kind of a buzzy sound that they'll make. And sometimes honeybees will do this prior to swarming. And so a lot of the press and bloggers kind of really jumped on this and said, you know, oh, this is our smoking gun. This is what's showing that, you know, cell phones are killing our bees. So they really jumped to that conclusion really quickly. And but really, just because the bees made some sounds in the hive doesn't prove that the cell phones are causing colony collapse disorder or harming them. So, you know, the jury's still out on that one, and that we need some more scientific evidence that cell phones don't have an impact on bees. You know, that's where from my perspective, I don't see any evidence that cell phones are the problem, particularly because a lot of apiaries are located in places where cell phone coverage is poor. You know, they're out in the country. They're, and those bees are still collapsing. So, so I would like to see some more studies done on this, but so far I would say that's, you know, I think we're jumping to a conclusion.
Dave, you have any comments to share with insight?
Yeah, I just unmuted. No, I agree with Steve. From all I understand across the world, in fact, the people that did the initial studies from what I read, I think a year ago, that professor, whoever that was, that researcher, actually recanted and said, I'm going to take it back. I was wrong to even start that whole myth. And yeah. So I would, whenever I hear someone say, oh, about cell towers, I just don't believe it. Mm-hmm. So, but there's a lot of other problems out there.
Yeah,
Steve,
right.
What about diseases? Mm-hmm. I mean, just what type of diseases are happening? And I understand there's more coming out.
Well, they keep finding new viruses on honeybees. And it seems like the more we look, the more we find them. And so there's a virus called the invertebrate iridescent virus that has been implicated as maybe one of the factors in colony collapse disorder, also the Israeli acute paralysis virus. And these are things that could be spread by varroa, so the varroa plays a role there. Mm-hmm. We've also got a fungal pathogen called Nosema, and this one has become quite widespread. And you add all these things together, and you've got colonies with, multiple insults and can weaken the hive pretty quickly.
Thank you.
The big finger of blame used to spin around, and it was cell phones one day. It was high-tension power lines another day. It was diesel fuel. I guess there was an occurrence when they tested some bees, I think, from Australia or whatnot, and found an Israeli version of the acute paralysis virus. And I think one of the things that's made the whole colony collapse disorder tough to nail down is the fact that we're probably dealing with multiple things, and that we do have a tendency to get, because I remember the cell phone thing, when it came out, everybody, you know, just jumped on that bandwagon, was sure that was the problem, but I think we get distracted on these, you know, these little issues without stepping back and looking at a big picture, such as the diseases.
Nice. Now, we were talking about diseases, and we left off there before you got disconnected.
Okay.
Give us some basic stuff, and then in the next thing, the chemicals in farmland, if you guys could discuss that, share what are some of the problems.
Right. You know, so like I was saying, we've got Nosema, which is a fungal disease, gives the bees a bad case of diarrhea, basically, weakens them, can shorten their life. We've got viruses, several different kinds. And so, putting those all together, you've got bees that their immune system is basically pushed to its limit when you've got these multiple parasites and pathogens in the hive.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask Steve a question, if I could. Steve, this is Howard in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
With the immune system, do you think that part of the problem or maybe one of the contributing factors is that bees are now exposed to, like, monocrops? They're less of a diversity, so perhaps maybe their systems aren't capable of, you know, fighting off some of these things?
Right, and that is a really important point, and I think we're starting to see more and more. There's that evidence showing that, you know, when bees are raised in a monoculture and they're just getting, you know, one or a few different kinds of pollen and nectar for food, they don't grow as rapidly. They're just not as strong, and their immune systems don't function as well. So I think this is a piece of the puzzle, is that we need more diversity for our bees, for them to be at their healthiest in terms of floral diversity for them to feed on.
I wonder if this is one of the reasons why here in Hawaii we haven't seen any colony collapse disorder. Our two pests are really the varroa and the small hive beetle. But we're pretty much a diversified ag community where I keep bees on farmland. You know, it's not a single crop, although it seems to be shifting a little bit more towards corn. But there's, you know, we're growing different melons. We have, you know, basils and other herbs, you know, growing. And I think our bees have a little more, if not a lot greater, diversity. And maybe that's warding off some of the problems that we, you know, would have seen had we been, you know, more of a monocrop as opposed to diversified.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You know, a lot of our farms here in California are, you know, massive scale, and, you know, weeds are not tolerated very well, and so you've got just, you know, not a lot of diversity for the bees to utilize. And there's been a trend towards planting more corn for ethanol production. This is more a Midwestern issue, but a lot of our bees, you know, are migratory, and they go back to the Midwest, and, you know, we're seeing less, you know, land that was maybe in clovers or maybe in native grasses and wildflowers being converted to corn. And, you know, while bees can utilize corn pollen, it's not probably the most nutritious for them, and you know, the loss of diversity is not probably not good for them either.
Now, Steve?
Yes.
So when you actually look at the full gamut of what's happening with the honeybee, isn't colony collapse disorder down the list? Like the varroa mite, what both you and Howard are saying, is the number one.
Yeah.
I hear the beetles. I hear chemicals.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know, nutrition. And then fourth or fifth is colony collapse disorder.
Well, the thing with colony collapse is that we don't really have a good handle on what it is, and it may be that it is all of the above that we just talked about kind of coming together to create this symptom of a colony going downhill quickly and all the bees disappearing. So I think, you know, I think scientists are still trying to get a handle on what causes CCD, but it may be already, we may be looking at what it is already by, you know, the combination of, you know, monoculture cropping and varroa mites and Nosema disease and so on, and then then the colony collapses. So it's hard to really say what exactly colony collapse is at this point.
So the management practices, real quickly, and the problem in contractors managing or mismanaging their hives when they travel around. Can you speak to that? Is there any problems presented by that?
You know, beekeepers in general do a pretty good job, but sometimes it's not possible to, say, you know, control mites in a timely manner, or they might get behind on, say, feeding them, because a lot of honeybees need to get fed, and that kind of indicates, you know, low floral resources as well. But honeybee keepers feed with pollen patties, you know, pollen substitutes and syrup to provide them supplemental food. And if you let them go a little bit hungry for a while, or maybe miss out on a mite control opportunity, you can get colonies getting weak in a hurry. So. Mm-hmm. But, you know, most beekeepers keep a good eye on their hive. But, you know, another factor that enters into this, you know, to be successful as a beekeeper, you need to manage a lot of hives and it gets difficult to treat them all individually or whatnot. You have to kind of treat them all the same, basically, and sometimes that might not be the best for every individual colony.
So the rapid dispersion of the varroa mite, or the way we saw it grow, and is it suspected that just the fact that the commercial contractors accelerated that introduction or increase it? Does anyone speak openly about that?
Well, I can speak to that one. What happens, the almond industry is really driving a lot of the honeybee industry right now, because we need 1.6 million colonies to pollinate the almond crop right now. It's an 800,000 acre crop, and it requires 2 honeybee colonies per acre. So that adds up to about 2/3 of the colonies in the whole United States. And so they're coming from all over the U.S. to pollinate this crop, and this allows diseases to get spread pretty easily, because bees are pretty much, they'll stick to their own hive, but it's not 100%. If you mark bees, for example, from a hive and then go back and look in other hives a few days later, some of your marked bees will be showing up in other hives. So they do move around, and if they can't find their way home, they might just take up residence in another hive if they get let in. So that it's a, the almond pollination event is an opportunity for diseases to get spread.
And weather, how is that influencing the reduction or the decline? Is there any suspect relationship?
I don't know about the decline. It makes, for example, almond pollination, which is what I'm involved in, certain years can be tough to get the crop pollinated, just because you might have rainstorms and cold weather that keep the bees in the hives for a few days at a time. So it really can impact pollination. Usually the hives can weather that. They can hunker down and wait a few days for a storm to pass.
Mm-hmm. And finally, you shared with us of the colony collapse disorder concerns, but what about the plight of the contractor? I understand the bee contractors are getting older and losing money. What do you see for the future of this commercial activity?
Yeah, you do see that in the honeybee industry, is that beekeepers are an aging population, and there's not a lot of younger folks getting interested in that. But I do see that there are some, and I think it is attracting some new attention from young people, because they're reading more about bees in the press and want to get involved, and so that's a good thing. But beekeeping, it can be kind of a hard job that, requires some manual labor. It's often hot, hard, heavy kind of work, but it has a lot of rewards as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we do need to encourage more young people to get involved with bees.
Is there anything in closing we're going to... And I'd like you to give your contact information, your Dr. Steve Peterson, PhD, and if you could, give your contact information. And
right, I'm with Ag Pollen, and my email address is speterson, P-E-T-E-R-S-O-N, at agpollen, agpollen.com.
You're in Modesto, California, and a phone number, is this a workable number, 209-338-7110?
Right, that's my cell phone number.
And, of course, we'll post all of this up on the carolcox.com website, and interview. And you're from Modesto, and hopefully things turn out to look better, brighter. But right now, quickly, if you were to ask, how dire is it? Should we really be concerned? And real quickly, and if so, why? Or will this blow over?
Is this a question for me or Howard?
Yes, you, Steve.
It is a situation we need to really put more resources toward right now. Bees are vitally important to agriculture. I think most people have
seen that statistic of one-third of our food comes from insect pollination. That's mostly honeybee. We need to understand why beekeepers are losing a third of their colonies or more every winter. It may be multiple causes and difficult to sort out, but if we don't figure this out, there's not going to be enough bees to go around to cover all the acres that need to get covered.
The honeybee. Okay.
Yep.
I have a question for Steve. Just a quick question, because one of the things you just said was that beekeepers are losing, up to 30% of their colonies, every year. I was under the impression, and because Hawaii's, we don't participate in migratory beekeeping, that there's losses. I had read anywhere from 0 to 25% losses that you can normally expect, either starvation overwintering or just, bad genetics. What would be the number, what's the average loss, that a beekeeper might have and expect it? Would you expect to lose 10% of your hives? I mean, nobody really wants to lose any of them, but
right. The
loss is there. And I know when the CCD issue first came out was they would say, I lost 25% of my hives. But nobody ever asked the question, how much did you lose? What was your average loss, say, over the last 10 years? Has it changed much?
What I've heard growers state is that, or beekeepers, is that it used to be more like 10% of their hives in that range. And, 10, 15% of their colonies would go down each year. And that wasn't too difficult to make those back up in the springtime with, splits and making new colonies, and that, so they were kind of used to those kinds of losses. And then more recently, starting about 8 years ago, it jumped up to more like 30%. And this last season, 2012, 2013 winter, a lot of beekeepers lost 40 to 60%. It was a particularly bad winter. So, it's not appearing to go away, and, we need to get a handle on this.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Peterson, thank you for calling and sharing with us, and we appreciate you taking the time out to share with us. And
thanks,
we will
my
be
pleasure.
Posting this at carolcox.com. Aloha, and thank you.
Thank you.
Now, we also have waiting on the line is Ms. Suzanne Wainwright-Evans, who is an ornamental entomologist specializing in integrated pest management. Good morning, Suzanne. How are you?
Good morning, and thanks for having me.
Yes, ma'am. And you're calling from Pennsylvania. What part of Pennsylvania are you calling from?
I actually live in eastern Pennsylvania near Allentown, but I've actually been out to Hawaii several times working.
Oh, okay. And some of the on bees and issues such as that? You're what? BugLadyConsulting.com, right?
Yes. What I actually do is I work with commercial growers, teaching them how to manage their pest insects on their plants using beneficial insects, the good bugs that eat the bad bugs. So I'm not a bee specialist, but what my work does is it allows for pesticide-reduced usage, which then in turn helps all pollinators out there.
Mm-hmm. I see. And Dave, are you there?
I'm still here.
Yeah, raising bees, and if you could, can you speak to that? If you have any healthy garden, have a healthy garden?
Well, if I can, what this bee gap, bee gardeners adding pollinators, the intent behind that, as we're watching the honeybee decline, we see that we can sit there and hope for the honeybee to come out of this, but we shouldn't put all our bees in one basket. We should be looking for alternatives as well. Mm-hmm. And so the whole idea behind this gardeners adding pollinators, there's some bees out there that are just, there's across the U.S., there's 4,000 species of bees, not just one or two with the bumblebee.
Right.
And so we're helping the gardener realize that by having a healthy yard, tons of pollen, tons of nectar, and habitat, we'll talk about that a little later on, but all those things would provide extra bees, and it's getting these bees to the farmers is the important part. Will be out there in a couple of years. So that's the genesis behind this bee gap concept, that we need more than just one bee.
Right, and relying on more than one bee is better, a little healthier, right? Because if we found ourselves boxed in.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's. I think the industry has learned that once the tsunami hit Japan, you know, a bit ago, that they had all of their chip parts in one of whatever factories that was covered up, and the entire worldwide production was nailed. And we just, you know, we should learn from that and realize that we've got to have other bees out there. Although the honeybee is an awesome insect, we just shouldn't rely only on one bee.
And Carol, as part of the bee gap, is to have gardeners learn about healthy yards and what have you. And the chemicals.
So I don't think, is Carol on yet?
She should be. All right, anyway, it's chemical dependence. And Suzanne, if you could speak to that.
Well, talking about reducing chemical usage for homeowners, a lot of homeowners traditionally have used insecticides in their yard, not always understanding the impacts on them, because an insecticide is an insecticide. They're pretty non-selective. Because whether an insect is good or bad is kind of a matter of opinion. So when you apply an insecticide, you can kill the beneficials when you use them. So teaching homeowners alternative methods of management is a good way to go for them to help preserve their pollinators, because often they don't realize that they are killing the pollinators.
I see. Dave, are you there, Dave? You
have I'm still here.
Anything to add on to that? Or?
Well, actually, unfortunately, the gardener in our busy world, I think that we're so overwhelmed with whether it's soccer games or, you know, there's so many things going on. We reach out to the easiest source of expertise, which typically is going to be our department, our hardware store next to us, or, you know, Lowe's or Home Depot, and not that there's anything wrong there, but you've got the solutions on the shelf are typically the easiest ones there. I've got a bug in my yard I don't like. I'm just going to go out and spray to make sure it's gone. And I reach for the most powerful solution, not realizing what I'm doing. And I think...
This is Alicia. And so, Dave, I'm curious. The synthetic fertilizers that are sold in the many home stores for landscaping, I know that there's a misconception. I see this in my own family, where if something is green, it means that it's flourishing, and it means that it's healthy, and that these synthetic fertilizers are used to, quote-unquote, beautify a natural habitat. And I don't, you know, from my own experience in my own family, the understanding is that the green is good. So how do you think it's a cultural shift that's needed to... not only educate consumers on that maybe a less green yard is better, but that it's these home solutions that are, you know, like Suzanne is speaking to, that are actually killing our pollinators.
Such as, what do you, when you say home solutions, the Miracle-Gro or other chemicals, fertilizers?
Yeah, Miracle-Gro or Roundup.
Suzanne, what are your thoughts?
This is Suzanne. I have to jump in here.
Yeah.
I think with the fertilizers, you can't say that a synthetic fertilizer is going to kill a bee over a organic fertilizer. What it is that we do tend to over-fertilize no matter what the source is, and what can happen is when that pushes plants to grow, the plants can't chemically defend themselves as well because they can't grow and defend themselves. So what happens is you get all this lush growth pushed from fertilizer, no matter what the source is, and then the plants can't produce their own protective chemicals, and so then you get more insect damage on the plants, and then in turn people tend to apply more insecticides. There's a lot more research coming out showing that trees do very well without fertilizer. They don't necessarily need to be fertilized. But we are told through marketing that this is something we have to do every year. So
So it's important to, know truly if your plant does need a fertilizer. And oftentimes it could be that the pH of your soil is off. And if your pH of your soil is not correct for the plant species, it can't utilize the nutrients. So it can be a little, a little complex in a way, and that's why sticking with plants that are considered somewhat native for the soil habitat you have can definitely reduce your fertilizer usage on there. So, but with the organic versus synthetic fertilizer, the one thing with organic fertilizer, it definitely will help build a healthier soil. And if you have a healthier soil, you have a happier and healthier plant.
Dave, are you and Alicia still sharing the same conference call?
Yes, we are.
Yeah, I need you to call in on an independent line separate of hers because it's terrible, the noise that's coming back, being generated from that connection.
Okay, and you've also got Carol on the other line, the 1080.
Right.
Well, can you reach out and bounce off her? We'll change.
Okay, thank you. Alrighty, Suzanne, go ahead. And Carol, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Carol. How are you?
I'm fine. I do apologize, but we won't worry about that. We'll work through this. This is you're Carol Sevilla Brown, right? Conservation
yes.
biologist who firmly believes that wildlife conservation begins in your own backyard. You're an author, an educator, speaker, and passionate birder. All right. Butterfly watcher and naturalist who travels around the country teaching people to garden sustainably. If you could, make sure you give us your contact information afterwards and share with us some of the insights that we're sitting here discussing, how it impacts bees and how your info can benefit bees, the population, or pollinators.
Yes, I can be reached at ecosystemgardening.com, and what I do is teach people how to create welcoming habitat for wildlife in their gardens. And some of the things that we can do for native bees is, number one, stop using chemicals. Pesticides hurt the beneficial insects as well. You were just talking about fertilizers, which can kill all of the beneficial organisms in the soil. So the less chemicals that we use, the better off we are when we're trying to attract native bees.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing I would say is don't be too tidy in your garden. Many bees and other beneficial insects spend the winter in plant stems and fallen leaves and tree crevices. So when we do the fall cleanup that we've been taught we all have to do, we're actually throwing away the next generation of all of the native bees.
Mm-hmm.
Then I would say make sure you have at least three. I live in Pennsylvania, so we only get three growing seasons. Make sure you have at least three full seasons of native plants in bloom, starting from early spring and continuing through to the late fall. And the biggest thing that we can do is to add more native plants to our landscape. Native bees and butterflies and other insects have over thousands of years developed mutual relationships with those native plants. So the more native plants we are adding to our landscapes, we're not only helping to save those plants, many of which are going extinct too,
mm-hmm.
we're also providing much more habitat for native bees and butterflies and other wildlife in our gardens.
Mm-hmm. Now, in a person with very limited space, are they completely removed, or can they do something to help? Let's just say if you had a 10 by 10 square foot area, can a person plant or till the soil in a fashion that it would invite or encourage native bees nesting there? And I think I have Dave on the line as well. Dave has a product. Here in Hawaii, by the way, the disclaimer, we can't import any bees. Right, Howard?
That's correct.
And we don't want to be importing or encouraging importing other plants outside of Hawaii unless they're approved. But having said that, can you share with us what can a gardener do, or person in a little condominium, can they do something, or if you would?
Even if you live in a high-rise on the 24th floor in New York City, you can create a balcony garden using some native pollen plants to, you know, attract native bees, butterflies also. So, I mean, from window boxes all the way up to, you know, a three-acre homestead, or then we're moving into larger farms, you can do something, no matter how small your garden is or how large your garden is.
I see. Dave, are you there?
I'm here.
Yeah, and can you tell us about the there's a product that you have, or some gadgetry, I'll call it, not to be disrespectful of your product, but to enhance the population of native species, and Carol and Suzanne, if you could, when you say plants, could you give a list of plants for people on, we'll call it the mainland, there on the main continent, where, is it milkweeds or any specific plants that you would suggest? Go ahead, either of you.
Well, the list of plants is going to kind of depend on where you live. What's native in Florida would not survive in my Pennsylvania garden. There in Hawaii, you're having an enormous amount of trouble from plants and animals that have been brought in from other places when these are escaping and causing lots of damage. So you want to be very careful to choose plants that are specific to your area.
Dave?
And actually, that's what on that side of things that I think going natural is always wiser than importing something. So with bees, and specifically, my company raises bees on both East and West Coast, and we'll only ensure that the bees that we supply on the West Coast head out to the West Coast. You know, East on, because there's a lot of diseases that you can spread by inadvertently sending a some insect from California out to the rest of the world. Is Suzanne, are you still there?
Yes, I'm here.
What's going on with, like, when people ship out ladybugs? What happens there?
A lot of the ladybugs that are sold on the mainland are wild harvested from the Sierra Nevadas, and those particular ladybirds, because they are collected from the wild and not reared in a commercial factory, they carry a disease called Microsporidia, and they also carry a parasite that kills ladybirds. So people buy them thinking they're being organic and thinking they're doing the right thing, but it actually can create problems by introducing this disease and this parasite into your own garden. So moving insects, especially ones that have been collected from outside to one area, it can transport problems. And unfortunately, it's a pretty big industry because there's not a lot of overhead in being a ladybug harvester. But a lot of research has shown they're not that effective when they're wild harvested. It's much better to focus on your native ladybirds. And again, plants and plants that will attract them in, because ladybirds do require a fair amount of pollen in their diet, depending on which species. So you can plant for ladybugs, too, as well as planting for pollinators.
Mm-hmm. Carol, organic and myth-busting organics, can you, you and Carol, Suzanne, speak to that real quickly? And we're going to be, we've got about 4 minutes and before we go to break.
Well, I'll jump in and real quick and say that, you know, a lot of people are, especially homeowners, wanting to go organic. And there are insecticides that they will sometimes use that are approved for organics. But just because it is an OMRI-registered product, which is the third party that certifies products for organics, does not mean they are not toxic to honeybees. Organic products, again, do not mean safe for pollinators or insects. One particular product, the active ingredient is spinosad, and it is approved for use in organics, and it's available in many homeowner products, and it's a very effective product. It's used to control things like fire ants, thrips, and caterpillars, but it's highly toxic to honeybees. So just because it's organic, again, does not mean that it's going to be safe for your pollinators.
Mm-hmm. And the thing that I would add, I think Alicia touched on this I was trying to get through on the line, just because you have green and lush plants doesn't necessarily mean those are the best plants for bees and butterflies and other wildlife. Be very mindful about the plants that you choose to put in your garden. And your best results for wildlife are going to come from locally native plants to your area.
Yes, it's not easy. And that's, I think, one of the things, Carol, that we're trying to preach or to, you know, help the people understand. I think native is probably wisest. And when you think through what's being offered to you at the store, it's not always the best of your yard, because a lot of times you're just selling product to sell product, and you're marketing, and you're obviously trying to make money. And that's, I think, one of our issues we've got out there is there's just too many new products that are easier and easier to make your life, you know, I spray whatever and I have no bugs, or I spray whatever and I have no grass. Mm-hmm. And that just that toxicity is nasty.
And as unsightly and difficult it is to remove dandelions, they are beneficial, too, to a lot of the insects and the butterflies or other insects, bees and what have you. But one of the things, for example, myself, I don't use sprays in around my plants, but I do use a mixture of dish soap and water, maybe, you know, 2 teaspoons of dish soap to a half a gallon of water. And even that, as safe as it is in my mind, it will kill any insect once it's sprayed on them. So I'm thinking I'm being safe, but in reality, if it comes in contact with a bee, it coats it because of their exoskeleton, right? And they then preen themselves, and you know, they will die just as easy. So
this is Suzanne again. Let me say that real quick on using the soaps like that. Soap is not a soap is not a soap, and household soaps are not designed to have insecticidal properties. They have different carbon chain lengths. So when you use house soaps, which can be detergents or hand soap or dish soap, they actually can cause more damage to the plant that you cannot visibly see. There's actually been a study done by Longwood Gardens where they looked at using Ivory soap in comparison to insecticidal soap on tomato plants.
Mm-hmm.
And they both did control the insects equally well, but they did find on the tomato plants where they used Ivory soap, they had a lower tomato yield. Even though the plants, you didn't see any damage or burning on the plants actually reacted different to different soaps. So it's really important to use a registered insecticidal soap, because those are designed as insecticides. And you're going to be, it's going to be safer for your plant than any of the other household soap.
I generally use it to spray directly on the insect, but if in fact it hits the plant, and I usually wash it down, because it will burn and cause great damage to your plants. But Howard, you had
I had a question I'd like to throw out. And this is Howard. I'm a beekeeper and not a really good gardener, but it's been interesting listening to you talk. How would I, as a wannabe gardener, or if I was a gardener, who would I reach out to in my community? What would it be like the farm extension, or would it be a master gardeners club? Who would I turn to find out what native plants would be there, what the best design of, say, a garden that would support native pollinators, somebody who could educate. What would be that group for the communities?
Yeah.
I would recommend every state has its own native plant society. So there's one in Hawaii. There's one here in Pennsylvania. The best source of information about what native plants will survive in your conditions comes from those native plant societies. And they're very active. They're very willing to share information and give you lists of plants that will work well, whether you have shady or sunny or dry or moist areas in your garden. The native plant societies in every state are your best resource for the plants that will work the best in your area.
Okay. Pardon me just for a minute. We're going to have to take a break, and if you'd like to call back in or hold on, we must take a hard break here for the news. Is that okay?
Sure.
Aloha. We'll be back in about 5. Thank you. Keep on sailing till you lose your happy home. Sail on, my little honeybee, sail on.
It's time for the Carol Cox Show on K108, heard every Sunday from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. If you have questions for Carol, our number here is 524-1080, 524-1080.
Hey. Welcome to the Carol Cox Show. How are you? Who's calling?
Hi there. My name is Joe Fahey. I'm an organic farmer.
Hi, Joe. Sorry about that. We're having glitches, but welcome to the Carol Cox Show. And you're Joe Fahey, and you are calling from Peck and Bushel Fruit Company, right? And you are at, just for the listeners, out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Can you share a little bit about yourself, and we'll go from there?
Yeah, I'm an organic fruit farmer. In the upper Midwest, just outside of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, we have a new orchard that we started roughly in 2010. We have approximately 8,000 apple trees right now that, like I said, we manage organically. And we are using, for the first time this year, some of Dave Hunter's mason bees to help us do some pollinating.
Mm-hmm. Now, you raise dwarf apples. I saw a webinar that you appeared on, and I found it quite interesting, your results that you had. Can you share with us? You talked about the number of native bees required per acre and that produce a number of bushels, a number of apples. Give us a little bit of insight, and maybe that's encouraging, if you could.
Sure. Yeah, we in our orchard, we have relied 100% on natural pollinators to work their magic. We don't bring bees in. What happened last season for us is we had a big cold spell, and the natural pollinators didn't come out during bloom. We had temperatures in the 40s essentially during bloom. And that was a problem. These mason bees that we're working to work with Dave, these mason bees work in much cooler weather, and hopefully they're going to solve some of our pollination issues when we have these drastic swings in temperatures in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
Dave, are you there?
I'm here.
Yeah, go ahead and pitch in some of your involvement with the bee gap and what you're doing and the types of bees, and if you would, please.
So what we're the power of the backyard gardener across the mainland here, people don't realize that as we're learning from the cherry industry, one little bee can produce about maybe 12 pounds of cherries. Joe, we talked, you and I had spoken about one bee producing about 100 apples after you've thinned it. Is that about right?
Yep, that's about right.
Okay, and so to find the gardeners out there in Milwaukee for his, I think, Joe, you've got between, 10 acres now, or how many acres do you have running?
Yeah, about 10 to 15 acres, and we plant about 1,300 apple trees per acre, so that adds up to a lot of trees, a lot of fruit, and a lot of blossoms. So
about how many tons or how many apples would come out of your whole orchard?
Our whole orchard, we're probably looking at 15,000 to 20,000 bushels of apples, and that's hundreds of thousands of pieces of fruit.
Okay, so Carol, the cool part about this is between 20 and 30 gardeners in Milwaukee could contribute their bees to Joe. And it's that simple math, 20 or 30 that would handle the, might have to be up to 40, but still it's low numbers that would help him out.
Mm-hmm. Now, we also have Carol and Suzanne on. I want to make sure that we're disjointed because of the technical issues. But Carol,
I think they
might
have dropped off.
Is Suzanne there? Anyway, I will try and get them back on, but... why is honeybee such a great pollinating insect in orchards, and how does a quick insertion of hives and quick pull out help the farmer, or is that a...
From what I understand, and actually as I'm out pollinating cherry and pear blocks out here in eastern Washington, the ease, the wonderful ease of taking a forklift and pulling off some hives off the back of a truck and just placing them down there, and here's the bees for, all... week and a half or 2 weeks of bloom, and then picking them up and going on, it's so easy that you can spray chemicals on either side of it. The bees have got all their food that they want to forage right there inside the hive. There's the honey. It's unbelievably easy. And the infrastructure is all put together. You've got the whole honeybee industry has, thousands of people that it's a well-working, it's a well-oiled machine. To introduce something different, so now you've got a solitary bee that Joe's got on his land. If you're a normal farmer, I need to spray something, and when I spray, I'm probably going to kill off that bee. This bee is out there for 6 weeks, not just there for the bloom. So now all of a sudden you need some cover crop down below, natural clover or dandelions or whatever to sustain the bee so they can survive through that 6 weeks. It's not easy. This spring bee needs mud. Well, gosh, not everyone has mud. And, in fact, I've got a complete failure on my hands out in Wenatchee that we thought we had, as we stood out there, it's kind of a damp environment. We had these bees out there. We put them out, and there was soil that looked perfect mud. Well, about two or three days later, the winds picked up, and all the mud dried, and away 10,000 of these bees, about a good $3,000 worth of bees, all flew away. There's no mud. They left. Mm-hmm. How fickle is that?
Right. Now, for example, fertilization, fungicides, pesticides, and calcium, what is the key about calcium, and what is the importance of having calcium, or is it an important?
So, Joe, can you talk about that?
Yep. Yeah, calcium is just a chemical that we use for tree nutrition. A lot of times, if we don't add calcium to some of our fruit, we get certain disease problems. Also, the apple trees tend to uptake a lot of calcium, so sometimes we have to supplement calcium in the soil just to keep the whole system happy. So
that would be we would offer that same thing in home gardens or other. Nutrients or what have you that's needed in managing home gardens, Steve?
That's right, yeah. All these chemicals that we use, that use to treat disease, pests. They provide nutrition. And without these chemicals, you know, the fruit would be much, it would look much more different than what we're used to.
Okay. Howard, do you have any comment, anything there?
No, I was just thinking about, you know, the comment in the first segment was about the luscious green garden and how, you know, how beneficial or how, you know, well that works out with our fruit industries. You know, are we pumping up our fruits so they look good? As opposed to, I mean, is there a difference between if we didn't use these things? Would the fruit still have the same nutritional value, maybe just not, you know, maybe not look the same?
Yeah, the fruit would have the same nutritional value. It just, the efficiency that we can produce fruit would be, you know, halved, you know, at least. And cosmetically, you're looking at a totally different animal if you don't treat the trees, so... That's the difference.
So the consumer comes into play. The consumer wants something that looks attractive. And I guess that's here in Hawaii, our ugly oranges.
Mm-hmm.
they're really tasty, really juicy, you know, very good oranges. They just don't look like a navel orange, you know.
And very sweet. And a lot of them come from the rainy areas that you get the mold or the...
Yeah. Not a very pretty orange, but
awesome tasting.
Awesome taste.
And not as citric, sweeter, actually.
Not knocking the navel oranges, but just a big difference between the two. One looks really pretty, and it's okay. And the other one looks really ugly, and it's just a magnificent fruit. It was just a question.
So you...
Yeah, it's there's a lot, you know, there's a lot of education that could be done out there, you know. If we could get away from a lot of these chemicals and accept some lesser quality fruit, the trade-off is probably better tasting fruits and vegetables.
So, Joe, is that part of your marketing scheme? I mean, do you actually have apples that aren't beautiful?
We do, you know, but, you know, we'll sell them as seconds or use them for cider. But we still shoot for, you know, a high percentage of kind of grade A fruit because... The bottom line is that's what sells, you know, and we try to do as much educating as we can, but it's hard.
Mm-hmm. And so part of this B gap, you know, this might be a couple of years down the road, is that marketing scheme right there. You know, that if you, the consumer, care, instead of being a consumer, you're a prosumer, you actually care about where your fruit comes from and what happens to it and the chemicals involved with it, if we can just educate the gardener on there, then that might free up you, you know, the farmer, to have a less toxic environment, you know, and to produce fruit that might just taste better.
But it's nothing new to actually have a consumer to take action. For example, in the grape industry, because of the payment and the salaries and the treatment and the grape orchards, vineyards, people refused to buy certain grapes because it was provided pretty much slave labor or cheap labor and hardship on the workers. So maybe we, our businesses, need to tell the public it's okay to have an apple that is not so perfectly round as in the eye of as we've seen, right? We just need to start that campaign. And why would we put wax on an apple? You know, to make it look shiny. It doesn't make it any sweeter, right? In fact, it may present problems. So I think it's about changing the mindset and educating the consumer.
That would be wonderful. That's what we're trying to do every fall here in the States. So.
And besides, if we did do it, what are they going to get the apples from? I mean, they're going to, you know, if they love apples and we don't put certain chemicals or have it perfect, they take what they can get, I would think. I don't mean to be crude about it, but...
No, you're right, and they're actually ending up with a better product. So it's just a matter of education.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to try and get this the caller on the line, I guess, if you could hold. Caller, good morning.
Hi, it's Steve Peterson again.
Yes, Steve. Thank you for calling back.
Sure.
Dr. Peterson. Go ahead. I don't know if you could hear us, but we're talking about, we're talking with Joe Fay about his dwarf apples and the use of bees and native bees and what have you. So, how about you? What about the use of native bees? I don't recall if you spoke in depth of that, Steve, if you could.
Right, yeah, I've used alfalfa leaf-cutting bees, which actually are not a native species, but it's a solitary bee, and blue orchard bees, which also called orchard mason bee, by the way. But that one is a native species, and it's a great pollinator for a number of crops, including almonds, apples, cherries, pears, blackberries, things of that nature.
I see.
So Steve, when you're out there using the leaf cutter, that's more of a summer bee.
Right.
But are you able to use that on blueberries? You know, can you? I wouldn't say manipulate the insect. You know, is it a viable insect to be used in a variety of crops?
Yeah, you know, the alfalfa leaf cutting bee, you know, originally was used in alfalfa seed production and primarily in the Pacific Northwest, and now it's being used in canola in Canada. It is being used on some vegetable seeds like lettuce, carrot seed in cages, and it has been shown to be useful in pollinating blueberries as well. That's probably not its favorite flower to visit, but it will visit them in certain conditions.
Mm-hmm.
So it has a range of crops that it'll visit, and it's not nearly as wide, you know, as generalist as what the honeybee can do, but it has its uses in several crops like that.
When you look at the solitary nature of most of these bees that you're talking about, the native bees, and for example, bumblebees, we have to remind the listeners out there that they don't produce honey as much as compared to the honeybee. Isn't that correct?
That's right. They don't produce honey at all. The bumblebees produce small quantities for themselves, but it's not in any harvestable amount that we can use.
Mm-hmm.
And the honeybee is a social insect, but it doesn't have a colony that will live throughout the year. It kind of dies out, and then reproductives are produced, and the queens then overwinter by themselves, and then they have to start up a new colony. So they're a little bit more challenging to work with, but they're really good at certain crops like tomatoes. A lot of our greenhouse tomatoes have been pollinated by bumblebees now.
Mm-hmm.
And blueberries. Bumblebees are really good at pollinating the blueberry flower.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, Carol, probably your listeners don't realize that there's two kingdoms of bees, per se. One is social. So honeybees, bumblebees, you know, hornets and wasps that are, they communicate and they work as a whole hive, one queen and a lot of, you know, worker bees. Whereas with the solitary, these bees are every female is a queen. And they all, I'm going to say all bees, social and solitary, all live about 6 weeks. But with the, you know, so as a social bee is out there, 1,000 eggs are laid a day and 1,000 bees die a day. But on the solitary, they all come out about the same time, and you know, males are there for a couple weeks and die, and the females are there for 6 weeks, and then they're all gone. So the spring bee that Steve's talking about, the blue orchard, is a wonderful spring bee, but by 6 weeks later, it's gone. And so, but we can control that. Steve's out there in the almond industry putting these out, what, middle of February, Steve?
Right.
And then I'm right now, I've taken that same bee, it's in a cooler, it's just in a cocoon, and I've still got that bee, so 3 weeks, 3 months later, I've got this bee that I can put out for a crop right now. So it's just there for 6 weeks, but you can kind of spread its, you can choose when to put that bee into your crop. Now, there are other bees, so where Steve's talking about the leaf cutter, this is a hot weather bee. This comes out in the, you know, 70s and 80s, and there's the blue orchard comes out in the 50s. And there's bees that come out in the 60s. So different times of the year, you've got different solitary bees coming out. And so the question that we're trying to answer is, as the honey bee begins to just be challenged in multiple crops across, you know, the full season, what else is viable?
Mm-hmm.
It's just important to know that.
Howard, Yeah, as I listen to you talk about the solitary bees, the question that comes up to me as a beekeeper and a provider of pollination here in Hawaii, that the honeybee, being a generalist, is really an ideal pollinator. You know, the colonies, in theory, are supposed to last forever. Of course, they don't anymore. The amount of work that it seems like for the solitary bee, especially one that lives 6 weeks, are the economics there? Is it going to cost, you know, so much to do these solitary bees, you know, with a six-week life and having to store, you know, the future generations? Is that going to cause an increase in, you know, to the farmers who are using these?
That's a good question. You know, the alfalfa leaf cutting bee industry is definitely an established industry. There's farmers who are raising these things and selling them and staying in business. You know, it's been going since the late 60s. What they've been able to do, though, is mass produce a lot of these bees to get the cost down on them. And so there are certain times of the year where you're working hard at either taking them to the field or bringing them back, stripping them from their nests. But then there's a large segment of the year where they just go into cold storage and sit there, so there's not a lot of labor or work that you have to do at that time of the year. You know, like Dave was saying, you bring them out at the appropriate time and you've got, you know, a lot of bees ready to go all at once. So blue orchard bee, we're still working on getting the economics to come out right. And with honeybees and almonds going for around $150 per colony, that makes it to where the orchard bee can be competitive at those kinds of prices.
Mm-hmm. And actually, Howard, it's not that you have an industry that's trying to shoehorn into the well-established honeybee industry. Rather, it's an alternative that mm-hmm. if the honeybee continues to be challenged, at some point we're going to have less pollination out there and no solution. And so, although it is tedious and it is a lot of extra work and a lot of knowledge has to be learned about these bees, it's going to be important if we want to have food on the table. You know, and we can, what this discussion, you know, a lot of it is, can we provide alternate insects to a stressed out industry, pollination?
And, you know, one of the things that you did point out is that when you do have the dead time as a keeper of honeybees, I'm still working.
Right.
You know, when there's no crops in the field, I'm still, you know, I'm working hard just to make them survive the winter. You know, arguing with a farmer, hey, cover crops, you know, don't let my bees starve. So I guess there's a trade-off in them, and I think that here in Hawaii, we have honeybees, of course, which are not native. We have carpenter bees, which are like bumblebees, if you're not familiar with them, leaf cutters and sweat bees. But what we're doing now is we're encouraging farmers to use, you know, all of them. Don't just look at the honeybee as your only game in town. You know, let's put some habitats up for other bees because they are beneficial and they do tend to like different plants. So I just wish we could bring in other types of bees.
Now, speaking Hawaii, is there an active program that either of you know that where there's actually recruitment and use of native bees for pollination? Is there anybody?
The native Hawaiian bees are solitary and pretty much deal with, I guess you'd want to call it pre-contact. You know, vegetation. I'm not quite sure when the carpenter bee arrived or the leaf cutter bee. I think those are probably introduced as is a honeybee. There are programs that UH Manoa is doing, Ethel Villalobos and her crew, in educating the farmer about different types of pollinators because the honeybee. The challenges that the honeybee has, not only in maintaining a population, but also a lot of beekeepers here are getting tired. It's a lot of work now. And whereas the leaf cutters, are a little easier to work with. You know, not as much management. The carpenter bees, not as much management. They like different types. So there is a program to encourage them to, you know, not only support the honeybees, but also, you know, establish habitats and pollination fields for other types of bees.
Now, in the northern hemisphere on the mainland, there's 250 species of bombas. How many do we have here?
I don't think we have. We just have the carpenter bee. I don't think there's no bumblebees here.
No bumblebee. Just a carpenter bee.
Just a carpenter bee.
And on that note, with carpenter bees, if you want to enhance them, take some holly core, a nice old wood, sit it out in the back, away from your home, and they'll actually colonize.
What we're saying now is take about 1 foot lengths of bamboo that have an inside opening of about a half inch, and lash maybe 12-15 pieces together and hang it up, and they'll use that. Instead of your house. And that's working. We've been passing that information on at the farmers markets, and people have been doing that, so they're actually less on a kill campaign. You know, my favorite term for the carpenter bee is a termite on steroids. I can chew about an inch a day, and they appear to live, I think, about 2 years. And so you can end up with a fairly large colony, making Swiss cheese out of your, you know, fascia or fences or...
Not very good.
I've actually found it successful in just stacking the holly core or softwood when it dries and rot, and they are aggressive.
Right,
go there.
Right.
And the nice thing is the bee is not aggressive toward humans. They may buzz you, but very tolerant of humans.
And the big question here is, Steve or Dave might be able to answer this, is people ask me all the time, do they stink? And I've kind of dissected one, and I don't see a stinger. I've never been stung by one. I hear they can do a nasty bite.
They do have a stinger.
They do?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Like the blue orchard bee and a lot of these other solitary bees, they really kind of rarely use it on people. So that's one nice thing about being around them. They're pretty gentle to work with.
Yeah. What we always kind of say, Howard, is that if you go up and kick a hive, run. or don't kick the hive.
Right.
But with
right.
your solitary bees, they're just gentle. They don't because the female has to do all the egg laying and pollen nectar gathering, etc. She can't sit there and guard the hole and do everything else. So she chooses not to. And so her chemistry, if you can get stung by a solitary bee, the venom is just low. I mean, less than a mosquito bite.
What
we've learned.
We're actually trying to raise carpenter bees. I've been trying to provide some habitats and trying to get them to be used as, especially in our pumpkins. You know, the big flower, they just delight in the big flowers.
Joe, are you there still?
I am.
We didn't want to exclude you from this conversation. So you have anything to share in or add to that?
No, I'm enjoying the conversation. I'm excited to get started with the mason bees and add them to the natural pollinators that we have currently in abundance. And I do want to add that as a farmer, you know, I've seen the benefits of planting cover crops in our fields, clover and things like that, so that they do have a food base all season.
And what is wrong with this idea of, you know, windbreaks, for example, in farming areas? Why not plant, have strips of alfalfa, or just if you're raising almonds, have a strip of flowering plants that would attract pollinators? Does that compete with the, or reduce the pollination of the almonds or the targeted crop, or does that present a problem?
From what I've seen, no, it doesn't create a problem because almonds are very attractive when they when the flowers open up. They've got lots of nectar and lots of pollen. Bees just really love that. They are all over it. Sometimes they will end up stripping the trees of all the pollen and nectar. If the weather's good, there might be little left by the afternoon, and then they're looking for something else. And then you might find them going out into whatever else happens to be in bloom. But it's pretty hard to actually divert bees away from something like almonds when they're in bloom. They're very attractive. So I don't think it hurts the farmer at all if he wants to put in some cover crops for bees and other wildlife.
I was asking that because of the monocrops, or the which this would introduce a different minerals or whatever is needed for the biology of the bee itself, as you spoke earlier.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we had an integrated pest management seminar last year, and one of the things they were talking about was creating fields of something other than, you know, what you're planting, just to have a little diversity, not only to support the pollinators when you don't have crops, you know, in the ground, or when you're growing a crop that doesn't have flowers, you know, giving them something else to go to and maybe strengthening them that way, you know, just having that diversity.
Either one of you can add, what about legumes? Are they a good plant, flowering plant, sweet peas, or do they present a good source of nutrients for bees, or is it not?
It would be, you couldn't put those out with the almonds, you know, because it's a February crop, February-March crop, and your legumes are out there deep in July, at least out here on the mainland, and so to have, I think actually by the time the summer hits around, your ground nesting bees are coming out. It's more the critical crops are the bees that rely upon when your ground nesters are native ground nesters are all hidden in the ground. It's the critical crops need, whether it's a honeybee that you've implemented or your solitaries that are very temperature specific. And so it's the, I'm going to say it's your blueberries, apples, cherries, pears, you know, nashis, all of these ones are the ones that are probably today the crops that are most critical.
Right. So, guys, Randy is supposed to call in, and unfortunately, Carol and Suzanne, we got disconnected. If they can call back, is there anything any of you want to say in closing real quick, so maybe we can, Dave, you could let them know they can call back in?
I think Suzanne's gone, but we do have Randy probably trying to call in. So, Joe, it would be great if you could pop off for a bit and see if that line opens up.
Yeah, go ahead. Are you there, Joe?
Yep, I'll do that.
Do you have anything closing real quick, just in case we get stumbling and not get back to you, anything? And give us your contact information.
Sure. No, I appreciate being on the show. It was a great discussion. And if you want to take a look at what we're doing, you can visit my orchard at www.peckandbushel.com. And thanks for having me.
Yes, thank you, Joe. Joe Fay from Milwaukee, right?
That's right. Right outside of Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
All righty. Aloha to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Right. Steve, go ahead. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Anything you wanted to share with more insight on that? Or?
Well, I've really enjoyed the discussion. And, one of the areas that we've been looking at here in California is planting more wildflowers, both native and non-native, seeing what works, seeing what the bees like. And I'm involved in a research grant, and it's called the Integrated Crop Pollination Project, and we have a website, and it's www.icpbees.com. And Dave Hunter is an advisor to that project, and we're just trying to find, you know, how can we make a habitat that enhances pollination of the crops and maybe provides more habitat for wild bees and help out our managed bees as well.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Aloha. And we'll talk again. We'll post this at carolcox.com, Dr. Stephen Peterson, or Steve Peterson.
Right. I think Randy's also trying to get in now.
All righty. Thank you. Aloha.
Okay, aloha. Bye-bye.
So, Carol.
Yes, I'm here.
See if you can find Randy Bigby. He's out on the North Carolina. He should be online.
Good morning, Randy.
Well, good morning.
Aloha.
Aloha, Carol. Thanks for having me on the call.
Well, just remember, it'd be this way sometime. Anyway, thank you for your patience, and I do apologize to Carol and Suzanne. But, Randy, if you could, please, tell us a little bit about yourself and all of the good things. I know you're 69 years old, so you have a lot of knowledge, and you're an ex-Navy vet, Special Forces, underwater demolition team.
Oh, boy, you got it.
Well, when did you get this gentle side to deal with bees, Randy?
Oh, it's just amazing, Carol. It's a matter of fact, probably about 3 years ago, I started to delve into it, and ironically, I just hit a brick wall because nobody knew anything about them, and about 4 months ago, I got rekindled, and it's pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm. And you're working with Dave Hunter, the B-Gap?
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good team.
All righty. Well, tell us, Dave, Randy, what regarding the alternative, the alternate pollinators, how are you using them, and what have you found the benefits?
Carol, I live in the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. I'm absolutely amazed at the lack of knowledge. You know, you've heard the term a dog with a new dish.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's no dish. I mean, these people have to be, even the people at the university, I'm a master gardener, they haven't heard or even seen mason bees.
Mm-hmm.
It just absolutely blows me away. You know, it's kind of like the pig in the pen.
Mm-hmm.
You can take the pig and clean him up and put a bow on it, take him in your house, put him on the couch and give him a remote control. You better not turn your back because he'll head out the door and go right back into the pen.
Mm-hmm.
So what we have to do is get the pen out of the pig, meaning we have to re-educate these people and show them that their only alternative is the mason bee or the orchard bee or the pollinating bee.
Mm-hmm.
It's truly the answer that we have. With the food crisis that we're going to have unless we increase the numbers of these bees.
Now, because I do have Howard here, who is a commercial pollinator with the honeybees, and I have on the left here Dave and Randy about native bees, is there any contention or concerns from the industry of the commercial pollinators? If you guys could give me your insight or opinions or stance on that. Does a commercial pollinator feel threatened by this introduction of the surge of the talk of using native bees?
Yes. And it's, as I've been running the Crown Bees, my company, for a good 3 years, the pushback is becoming less. I think it's a slow introduction. But there is only Howard, I say this lovingly, to many of your peers out there, there's only one bee in the world. And it is that. And in an area of crises, as I spoke with the California president of the Beekeeper Society, he was very defensive. You know, we don't have time for another insect out here. We're just focusing on our insect. I said, but shouldn't you, could we help teach your beekeepers about another bee? Because you already have the infrastructure. You've got the knowledge of the farmer. You've got the knowledge of what needs to be pollinated. Could we help team with you and, you know, work as a team to get the farmer pollinated? Well, we'll see when that happens. Well, okay, and that's okay. But I believe that the integration of other bees into the beekeeper's back pocket will help both them out financially and help out the farmer. Randy, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I'd like to make a comment. Dave is quite the opposite here. We've had first and second and third generation. Can you guys hear me okay, by the way?
Oh, yeah, just a little accent coming across.
Okay, I'll try not to. I can't talk loud or slow.
No, we're fine. I'm
Carol, quite the opposite. Here in the mountains, we've got second and third generation beekeepers that are very discouraged. They're losing bee gums like crazy. They're just shutting up shop. And
wow.
Spread the word through open markets. I have a tent every week, and I never knock the honeybee. I said we work in conjunction with the honeybee. I'm very well received
mm-hmm.
here in Wilkes County, and, of course, Allegheny County is up in Boone, up in snow country where they ski. tons and tons of orchards and organic farms, and I haven't the word has not gotten out yet to them, but I'm very well received in this area, and it's just a matter of time. I certainly encourage all the honeybee people to do whatever they can do, but if something is happening in that arena, then we have to do something to take up the slack, Carol.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Randy, by the way, I'm from Mississippi originally. So, and
I'm from Bay St. Louis, Mississippi. That's where I was born.
I know. That's why I said mentioned the hint of the accent.
Oh.
I was born in the panhandle of Florida.
What were the chances?
Howard's from the panhandle of Florida, so southern folks, you know, going to have solutions for the world, right?
The comment that I have is sometimes my pollen interviews in Hawaii are not appreciated by my, you know, beekeeping associates, because when beekeepers have a habit of thinking that you know, the honeybee is the only game in town. And we had a massive bee die-off in 2008. And there was a lot of concerns over, you know, crop production and flowers. You know, we were going to just have be a grain state or something like that. But nature hates that vacuum. And so there's a lot of other pollinators that stepped up to the plate, filled the gap. Maybe not as well as the honeybee can, just given the numbers. But so my opinion is that honeybees are not the only game in town. The biggest problem with a beekeeper is that I produce honey, and that's basically how I make, you know, how I earn my living. If I were to go to another bee, and this is probably the thing that's facing, you know, the beekeepers, is we have to move into paid pollination. We have to earn a living somehow.
Right.
And without a honeybee producing honey, then you know, we either have to sell a, you know, another bee, or we have to provide that alternative bee, mm-hmm. you know, some revenues. I have a farmer out here who says, well, I'll cover your expenses, as I moan about, you know, how difficult it is being a beekeeper out here now. And it's like, well, covering my expenses doesn't do it. Mm-hmm. The bees have to earn a living. They have to be earning me a living. And we are shifting here in Hawaii to more of a pollinating or paid pollination. And I think that's the thing that is going to happen, you know, throughout the United States. Probably it's happening. Obviously, Dave's doing well at it, or, you know, getting the wheels in motion for, you know, providing an alternate pollinator. But it's just convincing a beekeeper who has made his life selling honey that there is another way to earn a living.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that makes sense.
No, I think you're right, Howard. And that's as the world spins, new jobs come out, and there'll be room for, you know, pollination or bee managers or whatever you want to call it. It's going to be different. There's always a need for honey. But I think the landscape that we see today versus 10 years from now is going to have to change, or we'll just have less food out there, mm-hmm. and it's ugly. But we're, you know, part of a change culture.
Yeah, the culture, the entire thinking about bees and the demise has to change quick, because I was doing some reading on the Internet, and I came across someone provided me a link to the United Nations Bee Report, a study around the world. And I was turned off immediately when it says, well, in order to repeat any of this or use any of this, you must get first written, refer to any of this. And I'm thinking, we're in a crisis here. And you're in the United Nations, and I got to go through red tape to convey to the world or others or in my little sector here what the demise is right over the horizon. So I think there's going to have to some attitude adjustment in every aspect of it, correct? The commercial pollinators and everyone. And I think, what about funding? Does the government fund the native bee heavily as they do these subsidizing commercial pollinators?
Not at all.
I think it's the squeaky wheel thing. It's the government's throwing money at whoever's making the most noise. And, you know, beekeepers have tried to make noise, but they just don't seem to get, mm-hmm. you know, there. And I'm guessing because the, you know, the people that are doing native pollinators are a smaller community, even more so than beekeepers are, mm-hmm. you'd have to have a lot of megaphones to yell, or something really, really bad has to happen. There has to be a huge die-off.
And actually, Howard, that's you're right on target, that there's got to be it isn't necessary through the government. That's where Alicia, who has been offline for a bit, is working with the Albuquerque Film and Media Experience, where you've got just a slew of celebrities that are going to hear the message that there are more bees out there. The honeybee is, you know, the pollinator of choice, but we need to increase the visibility of these other bees. And so we believe through the work that Alicia's doing, there's going to be four panels out there. We've got, we're bringing in, you know, a variety of scientists, a variety of real live farmers. We're bringing a lot, you know, as many people as we can to hear assessment, but it's all going to be pushed through loud media channels. And to have, I think right now most people listen to bad news. Obviously, I get tired of it, and good news doesn't do well, but we do have a solution, and unfortunately, the solution is in the backyard of the gardener, and we've got to reach them, and that's through, Carol, your program here is awesome, that it, you know, the reach is just that next step.
Right. It's one baby step, but speaking of that, and we only have maybe six more minutes, guys, but regarding the mission of Albuquerque Film and Media Experience, our own Tina Cuzon from Pathways in Paradise, I think she's invited to participate as a moderator or contributor to that program, so hopefully that goes off well. But you got a scientific community panel forum at University of New Mexico, correct, as you mentioned. You, Alicia and Dave are for sure going to be there, correct? And when is this?
This is June 3rd through the 9th, mm-hmm. and it's on... the Bees Week is the full week. Actually, they've the producers of the AFME have pushed that this piece, Bees, and the Bees Week, is a central core. So they're going to be pushing as many celebrities as there are many producers, and I guess there's a good 10,000 some audience that goes through there. Bees are important, and there'll be Tina is going to be there moderating these panels on, I think, the Monday and Tuesday. Those are going to be recorded. They'll be live. That's, you know, there's a lot of attention going to be applied on this, and we're hearing it first on Carol's show, so you know, you get to release it here, Carol. But it's a step in the right direction. The Buzz Lounge is they've got a venue out there. It's a cool building right next to on Route 66, and the Buzz Lounge is going to be, I'm going to call it a Starbucks-y type place, but it's they're trying to push people through there just to understand the importance of what, Howard, what you're doing, the problems you're going through, mm-hmm. and Randy, what you're doing. You know, the pollination's important, and to bring in solutions instead of problems is this piece.
Randy, go ahead if you've got any wisdom.
Yes, I'd like to chime in and echo what Dave's program, the Bee Gap, Gardeners Adding Pollinators. I have a number of these bee boxes or nesting boxes with homeschoolers. The kids love it. It's educational for these families. You know, you get to the children, you get to the parents, and now there's a buzz going on here. I'll be working with the 4-H, which is through the Extension Center, the Agricultural Division of Wilkes County and the college, and I will be putting on presentations. I'm doing another big presentation to the Forestry Department. They've asked me to come in. They found out about me. So I think that the Bee Gap is the garden oasis is really the key. It's one-on-one relationship to relationship, and the people want to be educated. They know that these bees are gentle. They don't sting. The kids are not intimidated, and the children just love it.
Yeah.
So I'm really pushing the Bee Gap. It's a very, very grassroots thing that I think I can handle versus if the media comes along and gives us extra promotion or the government gives funding, that's fine. But if we can get to the gardeners and we can get to the Garden Oasis program, then we've really started the multiplication effort in that direction.
Now, I want the listeners to just, I think I'm honored to even have you appear, call in, Randy. Last name is Bigby, by the way. But Randy, here's some of his background. 6 years in Navy submarines and demolition with the Navy frogmen. Life ends agents 10 years after service. John Hancock Insurance Company. And then have been in agriculture for 5 years. I have a fig tree farm in Moravian Falls, North Carolina. Got involved with Mason Bees 4 months now. Love working with Dave Hunter. He is my mentor, of course, working with the private organic farms and orchards, placing wild capture boxes where possible. Look forward to being on the show. And thank you for appearing. And Howard's sitting here with a few, what do you call this? You got bees.
Carol's been admiring, I have three queen bees from the Kona Queen Company that came in. And don't like them leaving around, so they usually travel with me. So on the table here at the studio, I have three little cages, and each one with a queen. And
so, I mean, we have a Navy frogman and a Navy Special Services, and here's Howard walking around with his bees, his queen. Yeah. I love it.
He's the right man.
The one thing that I've noticed that as I work the farmers markets, the number of people that were who are not farmers by heritage.
Mm-hmm.
I'm, you know, ex Space Center. Mm-hmm. Randy's ex Navy SEAL. You know, there's people I work with that are architects and things like that. Mm-hmm. It's just amazing who's involved in agriculture.
Well, real quickly, guys, I got down to 2 minutes. If you could give me a little closer, if you would, Dave, if you would, by the way, contact Carol, and I will try to contact Carol and Suzanne, and I want to do justice to this and have them back on. It's always more time you can give to the subject. So real quickly, we got about two more minutes of this.
Okay. So everything that Randy has said, you know, about getting visibility and getting things going and pulling the media's attention away, it does take some funds. And so one of the, you know, a need to sponsor this movement would reach out to the pollinatorsupportmovement.com. That's a website out there that Alicia is tackling. And even to reach out to her, doyoulikefood@gmail.com is Alicia's contact information. I think that the momentum has started. And when we heard Steve Peterson with the almond industry, this is the first year they've ever had a bust. Maybe too many acres of almonds. Maybe, you know, the honeybees didn't completely pollinate their fields. And unfortunately, it's going to continue. And it hasn't hit the other orchards out there, you know, the rest of the mainland, but it will. And to be wise is to plan on other alternatives. And that's where my company, Crown Bees, we've got product, we've got bees. We're here to help.
Alrighty.
It's simple.
Well, thank you, Dave. Hunt.
Thanks.
And Randy, real quick, we got less than 30 seconds. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Real quickly, you know what? If you really want to hit the people in the pocketbook, think of the yield that you can get. If you don't have adequate honeybees to pollinate your crops, especially blueberries, then if we can make available the numbers for the Mason bees, we're not only giving them an average crop, we're giving them an above average crop. So the yield, the more the yield, the more the profit.
All right.
So that's an area that people will get their attention.
Well, thank you, Randy Bigby. Okay, Howard, real quick.
Oh, yeah, Carol, I'd like to thank you for having me on this show again, and once again bringing the plight of the honeybee, which is my area, you know, out to the public and having these people on. I learned a lot today. I'm looking for maybe a continuation of this.
We'll do it again. Well, I assure you. And I want to thank all of you, Dr. Steve Peterson of agpollen.com, Susan Wainwright-Evans, bugladyconsulting.com, Joe Fahey. He is with the Peck and Bushel, PECKANDBUSHEL.com fruit company, and Alicia Forrester Scott, who is with the Alicia TheExplorer.com. You can get her through there, or Alicia www.pollinatorssupportmovement.com, and again Carol Sevilla Brown, and we will have her back on. So thank all of you for joining in and listening to the Carol Cox Show. Aloha.
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 I don't mind you sailing, but please don't sail so long. All right, little honeybee.
Thank you for tuning in to the Carol Cox Show, heard every Sunday mornings from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. right here on K108. Tune in again next time for the Carol Cox Show, right here at KWAI Honolulu.